One thing about me is that I'm mortal, like I'm an organism, which is weird on its own. Like I'm a collection of literal atoms that decided to hang out together for a while and which will eventually be unable to hang out together any longer. And then I will, this is the weirdest part, cease to be. And there's nothing that can be done about that because, like, planets and stars also cease to be. It's a real conundrum, and I'm not going to find my way through it in this advertisement. But we can make life less terrible for those who survive us, and that's why there's life insurance. I have life insurance because the people who are counting on me will be supported after my atoms can no longer hold it together, and Policy Genius is here to make life insurance easier. Policy Genius isn't an insurance company, it's a marketplace where buying insurance is straightforward and affordable. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams, so check life insurance off your to-do list in no time with Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com or click the link in the description to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
Hello and welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where me and my brother John answer all your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. Hi, John. How are you?
You're so sad. That was the saddest intro I've ever heard.
Did my best.
You know, it's never a funny comedy podcast, but this particular episode of Dear Hank and John is going to be particularly unfunny because Hank's beloved dog, Lemon, has just died. Yep. And also because I have just learned in the last hour that the brilliant novelist Harper Lee has died, one of my favorite writers. And yeah, so don't expect any funny today.
Yeah, it was always a comedy podcast about death. Now it is just a death comedy,
Now it's just a death podcast about death. Now it's just to all death all the time. Speaking of which, Hank, before we even get to how we're doing, which I think the answer is universally terribly, I have to say that there is an important correction to one of our previous episodes, and this comes from Matt, who would like to inform us that, in fact, despite it being the shortest month, February is not the deadliest month, at least in the United States. August and September share the title for the least deadly month, with the August death rate being the lowest, while September is the lowest by total deaths. February is fourth in total deaths and third in deaths per day.
Wait,
still in the thick of the death season.
One of the things you said didn't make any sense there at the end. It's fourth in death rate and third in deaths per day. Oh.
No, it's fourth in total deaths and third in death rate.
Oh, this is too confusing for my brain right now. And
all I can tell
you,
Hank, is that February is a terrible time to be alive.
Well, it is.
Because your chances of dying are exceptionally high.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very, like, it seems very unlikely to me, and I would like to know why, except that it's cold and people are like, eh. Had enough.
Yeah.
Had enough of this. Living thing.
No, I mean, I am inclined to agree. The best time to be alive is probably August, maybe September, depending on how you calculate it. But January and February are just overwhelmingly the worst. To give you a little bit of context, in February, the average number of deaths per day in the United States is 7,081.
Mm.
In September, it's 6,051.
Wow.
It's more than 1,000 deaths per day less.
Wow. That's a big difference. That is not just a big difference in numbers.
I know.
It's a big difference in actual numbers of people.
I know.
Not just in numbers, but in percentage. That's very strange. And also, I'm kind of surprised by how few people die per month.
Well, in the United States.
But still, that's, I don't know, there's 300 million of us. It's surprising that only 6,000 people die in any month.
Well.
What do all the people who work for funeral homes even do?
All I can tell you, Hank, is that I cannot wait for August.
All right. Well, my favorite month is September. So I guess that plays out in the stats as well.
So we just have to pause briefly to commemorate the life of Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird. Harper Lee, who wrote, "There are just some kind of men who are so busy worrying about the next world, they've never learned to live in this one." And who wrote, "Mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy. They don't eat up people's gardens, don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." And Harper Lee, who also wrote the single greatest line of dialogue in American literature, "Miss Jean Louise, stand up, your father's passing." Hank, she was one of my favorite writers, especially when I was a young person. And when my son was born, we gave him the middle name Atticus, partly because of the historical Atticus, but partly because of Atticus Finch, the great hero in the novel To Kill a Mockingbird. And my publisher, Julie Strauss Gable, after Henry was born, sent Harper Lee some copies of my books. And Ms. Lee very kindly sent one of them back, a first printing of Looking for Alaska that she signed on the title page, "Welcome to the World, Henry Atticus, Harper Lee."
I feel like that was our short poem already. I hope you don't have another one.
But I have a short poem about dog death.
Oh, really? You found a short poem about dog death?
Of course I did, Hank.
All right, I'm going to take my headphones out. You do it, and then I'll be back. I like to sort of yell when you're done.
Okay. Today's short poem is by Mary Oliver, a great lover of dogs and also a wonderful poet. This is from her book, Dog Songs. And the title of the poem is, "If You Are Holding This Book." You may not agree, you may not care, but if you are holding this book, you should know that of all the sights I love in this world, and there are plenty, very near the top of the list is this one, Dogs Without Leashes. If you are holding this book, from Mary Oliver's book, Dog Songs.
I can handle that one.
All right. I tried. There are some sadder ones, but I didn't want to make you cry in our comedy podcast.
It's so funny. It's such a funny podcast, John.
Oh, man.
I'll tell you what, it's weird. It's very, my emotions make no sense, and they continue to surprise me, and I am learning about myself through this process, and what I'm learning is I ain't no rational being. That's not what humans are. It's something else. And it sucks.
Yeah, I'm really sorry. So. She was a great dog, and it is. I mean, it's a grieving process, and I think no matter what kind of grief you experience, one of my main conclusions from grief is that grief is super weird, and that if you try to judge yourself within the process of grief, you're only going to complicate matters because it's complex and weird, and I would argue that there aren't a lot of wrong ways to do it, but instead you just kind of got to let yourself be yourself.
All right. Well, I will take that advice, John. Do you want to talk about anything else before we answer a question?
No, maybe we should start off with a question about death.
All right. That sounds like the kind of thing that might happen here on Dear Hank and John.
All right. So our first question of the day comes from Abby, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I am the only child of a single parent who is dead. My father and I were extremely close, and his death 2 years ago was without doubt the worst thing that's ever happened to me. But it does mean that in this terrible economy, I am a 26-year-old with a low-paid artsy job who owns a beautiful home in inner London outright and lives alone. I sometimes struggle to deal with other people's reactions to this. Many people are confused by my rare situation and ask me how it happened, and answering is very awkward, and I've also found that some of my friends struggle not to sound jealous or bitter about it. As you host the best comedy podcast about death on the whole internet," thank you, Abby, "I thought you might be able to help. Do you have any dubious advice for me?"
God. It's good to answer questions that are, you know, universal. Everyone deals with these issues of having this particular situation. It's a very surprising and unusual circumstance you find yourself in, but I think in a lot of ways one that actually isn't that unusual. You know, the ridiculousness of capital, you know, of course, like I believe to some extent in the market and in the existence of capital. I understand that it needs to exist, but it is very strange how so many how we all have very different amounts of things, and that allows, you know, it makes it. Well, I think that the easy way to say it is, like, when you have more stuff, when you have more assets, your life is easier, and you can make different choices. You can, you know, it is easier to do the things that you want to do.
Right, but of course, I'm sure that also Abby would, in a heartbeat,
of course,
you know, give up her house in Inner London to have her relationship with her father back, or to have her father be living again. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so complicated. I mean, when we were talking earlier about how grief is inherently complicated, that's one of the things that's complicated about it, right? Mm-hmm, is that you know, it's you know, when you talk about someone who's died leaving you a legacy, you know, part of that legacy is a physical house, and mm-hmm. that is a great blessing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make the death any less horrible. It doesn't make the loss any less horrible. You know, I think that the only way to deal with those awkward situations is to acknowledge that they are awkward. Like, mm-hmm. just to be like, yeah, I know it is weird, and I feel weird about it too. But this is what happened.
Right, right. And it's almost as if, like, it's all a thing that we know. Like, it's a thing that we all know to say, like, I wouldn't give up a loved one for wealth, obviously. Like, that's a thing that we all know. But to have gone through it is a different thing. And to have learned that lesson the hard way. So, like, there is some awkwardness in... not just in inequality in material wealth, but in inequality in experience, and it can feel very scary and very uncomfortable to talk to someone who has lost something that, you know, that is unusual to have lost at the age that
right.
you are, and that other people do not have that shared experience, and sadly that will get more or less common. It will be less the case as you get older.
Yeah, it will become progressively less weird. But yeah, I think that it's... I always feel like with those awkward situations, really the only way to deal with it is to acknowledge the awkwardness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say, like, okay, well... it's funny, actually, it's funny, actually, is how I started the sentence. But... The night before we were taking Lemon into the vet to say goodbye, we went to get donuts, because that's how we were feeling. And so we went to Krispy Kreme. We were actually, like, out to get... We were just, like, picking up some food to take home. And we were, like... And then we were, like, oh, God, we're right next to Krispy Kreme. So we went to Krispy Kreme. And the guy gave us our donuts, and he said, so how's your night going? And we were, like, oh, I'm not going to answer that question. he's a very nice guy. He looked at me and he was like, well, I hope it goes better. And I was like, thank you, because it's very strange to, like, because, you know, the vast majority of the times people are like, how you doing? You're like, good. But I could not bring myself to say good. And he handled it very well. I felt like, in a way, I handled it well. But I was also a little bit like, do I look like the kind of person who goes to Krispy Kreme at 9 o'clock at night because I'm having a good day? That's just not.
I don't know
who I am.
I don't think there's anything wrong. I don't think that, like, it's inherently depressive to go to Krispy Kreme in the evening. I don't think there's any right time to go to Krispy Kreme.
I suppose. I definitely did feel like, well, this is not a thing that I would normally do, but. It did not make me feel better. I'll tell you that.
It's funny how that works. I find when I eat poorly, it makes me feel better only while I am swallowing the food. And then within 5 minutes, it makes me feel much, much worse.
All right, I have another question, John, if you're up for that.
I'm ready.
This one's from Daniel, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, whenever I'm having conversations with a friend about a problem they're having, I often find myself suggesting solutions to the problem instead of just listening. I find it difficult to tell the difference between when someone wants me to suggest solutions and when someone just wants to be listened to. What are some tips to become a better listener?" I feel like I do this a lot, and John has given me advice on this very topic, and so I am going to shush.
Yeah, because God knows you talk too much on this comedy podcast. Yeah, I mean, I can only give you the advice that my chaplaincy supervisor gave me many years ago and that I've tried to hold close to me ever since, which is don't just do something, stand there. It is incredibly powerful to listen and to listen empathetically. Mm-hmm. And so when I'm trying to listen to someone, I'm always trying to pay close attention and then also to reflect their feelings and experiences back to them. We've talked about this in past comedy podcasts, but empathetic listening can sound a little bit stupid when you're talking about it in the abstract. So for instance, if you have a friend who's saying, I'm feeling really afraid of abandonment because my boyfriend is talking about moving to Korea, you might respond by saying, it sounds like you're feeling afraid of abandonment. Ideally, you'll do it in a slightly more sophisticated way than that. So the person who you're talking to isn't like, did you just literally repeat what I said? But in my experience, even if you just literally repeat what they say, it's still helpful. They'll be like, yes, exactly. And there's just something about having someone else validate your feelings that's very powerful.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of times people are talking about their problems because they need to hear them. They almost need you to be there so that they can feel okay talking to themselves. And that's really weird. But we don't feel okay talking to ourselves a lot of the time. And also just to help tease the feelings out, because as I have found in the last few days, it's very difficult to know what you feel all the time. And so sometimes you just need to talk about it just so that you can know. And sometimes I want to get a therapist, even though I'm pretty well-adjusted person, just so I can have a person with a blank slate and be like, okay, I'm just going to hit you with all this stuff. You don't know anything about me. I don't know anything about you. Let me hit you with all this stuff so that I could just at least like hear what this sounds like to a person who isn't in the middle of it.
Right. Yeah, no, that's one of the big benefits of having having a therapist. I don't think that you have to have mental problems to go to therapy. I think, going to a psychologist is very different from going to a psychiatrist. I would recommend it, Hank. I've been in therapy pretty consistently since the year 2000. And my life has gotten consistently better over those 16 years.
Sure. Correlation and causation, always the same.
Yeah, but then again, like, I don't want to mess around with anything because the correlation is so strong.
Totally.
I know it's magical thinking to some extent. I have a question, Hank. It's from Mallory. It is a fascinating question. I do not know if you will be able to answer it, but I find it very beautiful. She writes, "Dear John and Hank, my grandpa and I have been in a very heated argument for about 2 years. He believes there is a possibility that another planet exactly like Earth could be in our orbit on the opposite side of the sun, making it impossible for us to ever see it and for it to ever see us." He saw this in an old movie once. "I'm no astronomer, but I did take some courses in college, and I don't think this could happen. Could this fictional planet exist?" What a great question.
Well, first, Mallory, I have to say I'm glad to hear you took at least some courses in college.
Yeah, Mallory did not say that she took astronomy courses, but she did take some courses.
There was at least one course, maybe two, that were taken during college.
Oh, man, I took anthropology. I took pre-calc.
Those two. I took some courses. I'm glad that your grandfather and you are able to have this spirited debate. I hope that it's a pleasant one, and it's also nice, I think, when you're having a debate, to know that you're right, which in this case you are. And but it is also important to recognize sometimes you're like, I know I'm right. I don't know why I'm right, but I know I'm right. And yes, Mallory is right.
Oh, dang it. I was hoping for a secret planet.
It's unfortunate. But the reason I know I'm right is not because I know all the reasons why I'm right. It's because I have faith. I trust that the people who study the universe have thought of this thing that was apparently in a movie a long time ago and have checked.
So you don't actually know that it's impossible.
I do know that it's impossible, but Mallory doesn't because she only took some courses in college.
Can you explain to me why it's impossible, please?
We have a pretty good grasp on the gravitational effects that all of the planets have on each other. It is true that its gravitational effects on Earth would be basically invisible. So there's a bunch of different reasons, as with like lots of cool things in science that we figure out. A bunch of different arrows all point to the same things. So we know how planets form, and we know that it would be extremely difficult for a planet to form this way. It would for two globs to perfectly pull all of the stuff from the planetary accretion disk into these opposite points. If they were even very slightly different masses, they would eventually come together, which is what happens and why there is only one planet in each of the orbits. Despite the fact there is a gravitational point at which you could put another Earth, and that they would go around each other. So there's that reason. There's also the, you know, just sort of like we have studied the Earth. We also have things that sense that are not on Earth. So you say like, yes, it could be there and we wouldn't be able to see it, but we have eyes in other points in the solar system. So there's lots of different reasons why this is not a thing that could be. But it's a fun thought experiment. And also, there are a number of weird gravitational points like that, and we do utilize those. They are like gravitationally stable points, and there are asteroids in those places that are sort of like stably following us around. But no other Earth, which would be amazing because it would be really easy to get to.
I was thinking we could get to our secret Earth. Mallory, I don't think you should tell your grandfather about this. I think you should just continue the argument.
The arguments that I have with my family members who I disagree with things on.
I was like, are you going to say that we are having arguments with our grandparents because they're all dead? But Hank's still fighting it out. He's still fighting it out with Nanny and Papa about whether or not gay
Global
people should be allowed
real.
To get married. They may be dead, but Hank is not done with that argument.
I'm kind of not.
You know, I will say at the end of her life, the New York Times started posting back then it was like civil union ceremonies for LGBT couples in the wedding section. And at the end of her life, my grandmother did say, well, I think that's a nice thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's a long journey to travel for a, 87-year-old woman.
All right, this one is from Ori, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, how do artificial flavors such as strawberry flavor pass as strawberry flavor when they taste nothing like strawberries? Does something in it trick our brains into thinking that strawberries taste like that, or are we just used to calling it strawberry flavor because everybody does?" I have a surprisingly complicated answer to this question. John, do you?
I have a theory about it.
Okay.
So this is my theory. Sometimes when I am drinking an ice-cold, refreshing, I don't understand why they continue to refuse to sponsor me, Diet Dr. Pepper. I will take a sip of that Diet Dr. Pepper, and I will enjoy it greatly for a moment until I realize that it is, in fact, Diet Mountain Dew.
Mm.
But my brain is so heavily expecting the flavor that it knows to be Diet Dr. Pepper that my brain initially is like, that's some good Diet Dr. Wait! Wait, that isn't Diet Dr. Pepper at all!
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's my theory, is that you are essentially tricking your brain with the color, and then you're also tricking your brain with the sweetness.
Yeah, you're tricking your brain with a bunch of things, and I think that absolutely does happen. And I also, for me, it is a guess. It is not something that I know anything about. But I do know some things about flavor chemistry, because it is something that I studied some when I was in college. I took some courses, and remarkably, so when we first were isolating all of these artificial flavors, which are the things that we use in candy almost exclusively, we pulled out all of these flavor compounds that have very strong smells, and they smell very good to us. And so we pulled them all out, and a lot of them tasted like, this tastes like a thing. We'll use it as the thing. But a lot of them didn't taste like anything, though. They just tasted good. So it was a flavor that we liked, but it was one of, you know, a dozen different compounds that was in a strawberry or in a watermelon or in a blueberry or something. So it was one of many compounds, and it was just part of the subtlety of the flavor. But when we concentrated it and stuck it with some citric acid and some sugar, which is the stuff that makes that was like the primary flavor components of sugar, of course, are like the actual tastes of sweetness and sourness. And then you have these smells that go along with it that are enhanced by those things. You get all of these chemicals that taste good, but don't taste like anything. So we had them. They're inexpensive to synthesize, and we like them. But they're just chemicals. So like they're named by the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry. They're not named by, you know, the long history of people naming things being like that berry grows in straw, so let's call it a strawberry or whatever. They didn't want to call it like ethyl methyl phenyl glycide flavored candy, so they called it strawberry flavored candy.
Today's podcast is brought to you by ethyl methyl glycyl rye candy. What is it called? What do you call it?
I don't even think I said it right. Ethyl methyl phenyl glycidate.
Today's podcast is brought to you by ethyl methyl glycosidylate. Delicious, but it doesn't taste like strawberries. But you're going to like it, and we're going to make it red. You're going to love it.
Yeah. All right. We're doing this. Today's podcast is brought to you by Too Many Sad Things. Too Many Sad Things. There's a lot of them, and just let them pile on top of you until you can no longer function or even move.
And of course, today's podcast is brought to you by delicious, refreshing Diet Dr. Pepper. Diet Dr. Pepper, not sponsoring me since 2007.
This podcast is additionally brought to you by Meloria, the actual planet Meloria, which is found just behind the sun in the exact same position as the Earth, but not by anyone, because it's hiding there and has been and will always be hiding there. Just an opportunity for us to consider what could possibly be if the Earth had it all to do over.
Hank, is that really the name?
Yeah, well, the girl's name was Mallory, who asked the question.
Oh, so you named the planet Meloria. That's very beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I figured it's what her grandfather would want.
I agree. I just thought of a joke that's too dark for the podcast, which is really saying something.
This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Blue Land. Blue Land's sustainable toilet cleaner tablets are here. You just drop them in, you watch it fizz, you brush and flush. It's like a bath bomb for your toilet. Don't put it in your bath. It's not like a bath bomb. I shouldn't have said that. Keep it fresh, maybe even remove some of the mineral deposits that you got going on in there, which are, I guess, is fair to say, unsightly. And also plastic-free. In fact, all of Blue Land's products have no single-use plastics. There are none.
You cannot get a single-use plastic at this place, because they're on a mission to eliminate single-use plastics by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and for the planet with the same powerful clean you're used to. And their toilet tablets are proven to work on a range of stains, including rust, mineral deposits, lime scale, and hard water. How do they prove it? I imagine they just put it in toilets. You can save more by buying refills in bulk or setting up a subscription. Their subscriptions are customizable and convenient, so you never run out of your most used products. Blue Land is trusted by over 1 million homes, including the one that I live in. We use their dish soap. We use their hand soap. We use their toilet cleansers. I like it. It smells good. They have a lot of different scents, too, which can make it kind of fun when you're getting a new one. See what it's going to smell like. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners right now. You can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You don't want to miss this. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. That's blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off.
Okay, Hank, we have another question. This one's from Kelsey, who writes, Dear John and Hank, I recently moved to a new city, and I'm in the process of making friends. However, the people I'm meeting make significantly more money than me and like to hang out at bars and restaurants. I can't afford to go out multiple times a week. How do I continue to explore these burgeoning relationships without draining my bank account? P.S., feel free to mention death in your response. Thanks, Kelsey. I appreciate that. I will mention death in my response. Here's the first thing that I would say, Kelsey. If you can just find a way to get to August, you'll probably live to January.
Well, that's good. I don't know
why you're so worried about your weekly spending when the first priority needs to be getting out of February.
YOLO!
So here's what I would say. This is always difficult and it's complicated. And I think it's one of the reasons that we now live in a culture in the United States where people overwhelmingly spend most of their leisure time with people who are in similar socioeconomic brackets. And which is I think one of the biggest social problems that we face as a country. But what I would say is don't go out multiple times a week. Go out once a week and then encourage your friends to come with you once a week to do something that is cheap, like go to a park and, you know, play.
Feed pigeons.
For some reason, the idea that came into my head, Hank, was to play a game where you throw eggs back and forth to each other, but you try not to have the eggs break. But
Are they in fourth grade?
Well, I mean, not only is Kelsey seemingly not in fourth grade, what with going to bars and et cetera, but also that isn't that inexpensive of a game because, of course, the eggs cost money.
Eggs are pretty cheap. Just don't get the free range.
Yeah, they're
one.
Cheap.
Get the sad chicken
eggs.
If
you're watching, your weekly budget, you don't want to just go throwing raw eggs at people.
No, I agree. Though compared with the cost of a cocktail in New York City, you could probably get about 4 dozen eggs for that.
Did I ever tell you about the first time I went to New York City with my best friend Todd when we were in high school? My best friend Todd came...
Did you have insufficient funds?
No, that was Canada. My best friend Todd is from a very small town in Alabama and grew up in a trailer park and had never been to New York City before. And we went to the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And we were at the restaurant there with my parents, and Todd saw that 2 eggs were $9. It was 2 eggs scrambled, were $9. And Todd said to the waiter in his thick Southern accent, "For $9, I want a suitcase full of eggs that I can take home with me."
It's a different time.
Well, now Todd is an extremely successful dermatologist, but I suspect that he still won't pay $9 for 2 eggs.
No, I understand that perspective. I back to Kelsey's question. I believe I didn't say that wrong, did I? It is Kelsey.
It is Kelsey.
I think in particularly in big cities, this is a huge issue because big cities are optimized to provide for every little slice, every little demographic slice. And where I live, there's just nothing you can spend much money on. So everybody is sort of on the same page for the most part. But in New York City, I think you really there are so many different, you know, economic brackets, and the city is optimized to you know, function for each of them individually. I cannot imagine having to try to figure this out. But there are, hopefully, you one can, when doing these things, manage to do it not so conspicuously on a budget. Oh, I'm just having seltzer now. I'm taking a medication that means that I can't drink anything that costs more than $20 a glass. that sort of thing. And don't be afraid to lie about that, about little white lies. John and I are big fans of those. And then
love a good lie.
And then, you know, also be like, you know what I think is super fun is Settlers of Catan, and bring them back to your place where I'm sure there's loads of space for a large game playing table, because it is New York City and everyone knows.
Oh man, when we lived in New York, Hank, we entertained in our apartment in the 2.5 years that we lived there. We entertained in our apartment once.
Yeah.
We had friends over to our apartment time.
It's so
and
hard.
It was horrible because it was so small. It was so cramped. We were trying to like make breakfast, and our kitchen didn't have any drawers, which is, you know, inconvenient when you're cooking for two, but when you're cooking for six, it's just, oh, it's just such a pain. Let's move on to another question so that I can forget about my New York City kitchen.
This question is from Dikista, who asks, Dear Hank and John, I'm in need of some dubious advice from two people who seem to be in stable, happy relationships. I'm a 21-year-old woman in college attracted to the male type, but it seems that nothing...
Well, that's your first mistake.
It seems that nothing is working out for me relationship-wise. I went out with this guy once, and I thought it was going really well, and he said he was looking forward to another date, and then suddenly, just canceled, and I haven't heard from him since then. My more hip friends, hip is in quotation marks here, have told me that this is called ghosting, where you just stop talking to someone to show disinterest, but this makes no sense to me. Ah!
Oh, God.
That was all in caps. Why do people take this seemingly easy way out when it seems like it's just better for everyone to tell the person you're not interested? We're adults, for goodness sake.
Oh, God, I never want to be single again. I can't even give an encouraging answer to this question because inside I'm just cringing at all of my memories of dating. It's just so uncomfortable when you don't know if you're going to spend the rest of your lives together. Like, the whole process is uncomfortable. Even when you've been in a committed relationship for like 2 years, it's still a little weird because you're like, is this forever? Or are you just like going to be here for a while and then you're going to go do something else?
You've always got that option. You've always got that thing, that maybe sitting there, that the choice. It's always a choice every day. It's like, do I want to be with this person or not? Until you go and you say, you stand in a fancy building and you say, hey, God, I want you to hear this. We're not going to break up. And then God's like, I heard you. And then that takes a little bit of that constant choice out of the matter.
Although I have to say, Hank, you did not stand in a building or, in fact, say anything to God.
We didn't talk to God either. No. Yeah, we said nothing to God.
You guys stood in a field and promised to stay married.
It's true. Well, we said it to our God, which was our friends and family.
That's fair. Anyway, point being, Hank and I are terrible at giving dating advice.
It's true, but I have watched this. I have a lot of young friends who are in the 2016 dating scene, which is admittedly very different from my dating scene, which was just grab onto and hold the first woman who will listen to the Mippy Giants with me, and never let go.
It's the true story of how Hank got married.
As I watched this happen, both on the ghoster side and the ghost-y side, I think what's kind of happening is that it's kind of a side effect of the tiny commitment of the text message, which is that it is a really insignificant social act to text someone, and it is also kind of, and so everyone recognizes that. Everyone recognizes that this isn't a big deal. You texted me, no big. But like, because there's this really low commitment form of communication, any other form of communication seems really intense. Like if you were to send an email to this person, it would be really strange. And like, why are we establishing a business relationship here? And if you were to call them, people would be like, oh, whoa, back down there, tiger. What are we married? calling me on the phone. And but additionally to this, like, very low impact, like, this is the only way you can communicate, and basically I see that you are not, like, it's not a big deal if I don't text back because you are just texting me and it's a low impact form of communication. I think also every single text message is like when you get one, you have to make the choice whether to text back or not. And if that choice isn't obvious, then there's always that, like, well, I can put this choice off. And not texting is a non-choice. It is a wait till later to make this decision choice. While texting is an active kind of a commitment, an active choice that you are making. And choices are kind of exhausting, especially when you have to make lots of them. And so you're increasing the number of these choices that you have to make. And I've watched, and it's like, what I would rather do is just not make a choice right now. So I'm going to push this off until finally the choice gets made for you, because they're like, oh, well, I didn't text them back for 2 weeks. It'd be real weird to text back now. But you never really made that choice. So I think that there's a lot of, like, this isn't about not being interested necessarily. Of course, sometimes it is absolutely about not being interested. But oftentimes it's not just like, I'm not interested. It's like, I'm choice exhausted. I have two, like, and I don't know, like, there's a lot going on, and I don't want to necessarily add this because it's not, like, it's not the 100% slam dunk thing that I imagine might could happen someday.
Having heard you, Hank, old man your way through this question, I have come to a revelation that is even more terrifying than the revelation I came to when I realized that I myself was middle-aged. Which is that I now have a younger brother who is also middle-aged. Like, while you were answering that question, you left early age and you entered middle age.
It happened. It happened. I should have used the word millennial at some point.
I heard it happen, and I'm upset. We need to move on.
No, I should just go full on and become a baby boomer and be like, you young kids need to make decisions and be more careful with each other's opinions of each other. And I don't know why all middle-aged people are from New York.
Oh, my God. Sarah and I had the best time a couple of weeks ago. A friend of ours who will remain nameless was using a Tinder-like dating app and allowed us to choose whether to swipe left or right on their behalves. And I mean, I totally get it. It was so fun. But let's move on to one last question before we get to the...
Do you not think I had good advice? Do you think that it was all bad and that
No, I mean, just... I think my advice would be to listen to your hip friends rather than Hank Green.
I just watch... It's so hard to watch young people date, and it just seems very difficult and very...
Yeah, I mean, I think it was always hard. I think it was always complicated, but it does, to our eyes, certainly seem more difficult and complicated than it used to. Okay, Hank, one last question before we get to the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon. This question is from Bethany, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, last year my fiancé and I traveled to London from Canada for vacation, and of course we attended an AFC Wimbledon game to show our support."
Oh.
That's awesome. Thank you, Bethany. Everybody in South London, everybody who visits London should really go to an AFC Wimbledon game. I myself am going to one in a week. But more on that in a moment.
Oh.
The game was incredibly fun to watch, but the best part of the experience for me was joining in with the crowd as they sang various songs to support the Dons and taunt the other team. I've never been to a sporting event where there was so much singing and camaraderie like there was at the Wimbledon game, and I'm just wondering, how did this tradition of singing at football games come about? I've never seen anything like it at sporting events here in Canada. It's true, you don't hear a lot of curling songs. or even hockey songs. You know, hockey's mostly about, like, cheering or making a lot of noise to make a lot of noise rather than about singing specific songs. And that's mostly true in American sports as well. You know, I think, as far as I know, the tradition goes back, you know, 100 years, that some of the songs that are sung are many generations old. But I don't know where singing at soccer games started. It is, however, a huge part of what is so enjoyable about going to a Wimbledon game, or really any game with good support, is that there's this energy in the crowd that is almost the game is almost irrelevant to the energy. Like one of my favorite moments, you can look this up on YouTube, Hank. I think it was Aston Villa fans. There were like 1,200 Aston Villa fans playing away to Manchester City, and they were losing like 7-0. And they started first off, they sang one of my all time favorite football songs, which is "You're Nothing Special, We Lose Every Week." But then they started singing, let's pretend we scored a goal. And then they sang that like three rounds of it. And then all 1,200 of them just went nuts, like just screaming, jumping up and down, hugging. It was amazing. And like, you know, they weren't even like watching the atrocity right. that was yeah. happening on the actual football field. And for me, that is what makes sports special and interesting, and especially makes soccer so interesting, is that it has that passion that extends way beyond whatever the results of the game are. And I really would encourage everybody to go to AFC Wimbledon games. I would also say it's only $35 a year to become an owner of AFC Wimbledon. If you can go become an owner of the team just like I am at the Don's Trust. And that's really cool, too. You get lots of perks. But yeah, it is a really special experience, and one that I will get to enjoy next week, Hank, because I am going to an AFC Wimbledon game. Yeah, next week against Oxford United, I think.
Well, I'm so excited for you. Is Oxford United good at football?
Let me look up and make sure it's Oxford United first before I answer your question. It is Oxford United. Now, let me answer your question as to whether they're any good. At this point, Hank, every game is incredibly important. But Oxford United is not just good. They are very good. They are currently third, which means that they are in one of the automatic promotion spots. The top three spots in the league all get promoted up to the third tier of English football. AFC Wimbledon currently in 10th.
Right.
But they have they're only 3 points out of sixth. So so we're just going to jump right into the news from AFC Wimbledon. AFC Wimbledon, Hank, played Luton Town last week. Now, of course, you remember Luton Town because of their significant role in AFC Wimbledon's history, I assume?
Sure, yes, of course.
You don't, do you?
No.
Hank, in 2011, just 9 years after the club formed, or reformed, AFC Wimbledon was in the fifth tier
right.
of English football.
Yes.
They were an amateur team, not yet in the Football League. You couldn't play them in FIFA. And they made it to the playoff final. The game, at the end of 90 minutes, the score was 0-0. At the end of extra time, the score was 0-0. And then there was a penalty shootout. And 19-year-old goalkeeper Seb Brown saved two penalties against Luton Town to send AFC Wimbledon up to the Football League and back to their rightful spot in professional English football. That same Luton Town, a couple years later, got promoted, so now we get to play them twice every season. And AFC Wimbledon played Luton Town last week and won 4-1, Hank. They won by three goals, which is great for goal difference, and two of the goals were scored by our Montserratian international. Ooh. The Montserratian Messi, some call him. Do you know who Lionel Messi is?
Yes, yes. I have heard that name. He's a tennis player.
You're kidding, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank God.
I am.
Yeah, so I call him the Montserratian Messi. The Montserratian Messi scored two goals. AFC Wimbledon beats Luton Town 4-1. We're in 10th place. I have to say, I am starting to properly dream.
Where are you at in the thing? Did you say, by the way, that the Montserratian Messi is Lyles Taylor, or did you just not say that name ever? Because I feel like you should at least use his name and not just call him.
At this point, I don't think it's necessary to say his name. I think we all know.
Well, I did. So that's a
who the Montserratian Messi
of amazing.
Is. There can only be
kind
one,
of amazing that
and it's Lyles Taylor.
I know that.
yeah. So AFC Wimbledon, to repeat myself, Hank, are 10th.
Okay.
They are 10th in the league
right now. I just didn't hear
that
part. Sorry.
Okay, but because different teams have played different numbers of games, if AFC Wimbledon win all of their games, there's like 16 games left, so obviously that's not going to happen. But like, if AFC Wimbledon won all of their games, and if all the teams above them won all of their games, AFC Wimbledon actually would make it into the playoffs. So,
okay, great. That's
I'm getting a little choked up here, as you can tell. But yeah, I'm starting to dream. I am truly.
I'm dreaming with you, John. I'm gonna have a dream. I had a dream last night that I had a bunch of tattoos and a really nice body.
I mean, I might get an AFC Wimbledon tattoo if they get promoted this season. I'm sure my wife would be delighted.
Yeah, I'm sure. All right, you want to hear some?
What's
some
the news from Mars this week?
All right. As you may have heard, we gotta feed ourselves, and one way to do it is just to bring all the food with us. But as we learned from The Martian, if you bring all that food and then suddenly you need to spend another 6 months on Mars, you got to take your Thanksgiving dinner, cut up those potatoes, plant them in the Martian soil, and become the greatest botanist on the planet. And it worked fantastically in the book, in the movie. So NASA is actually looking to simulate growing Mars potatoes in Peru, the home of the potato, by the way, if you did not know where potatoes came from. South America, surprisingly. Somewhat surprisingly, just because it is such a big part of what we consider European cuisine, but not since only after the Columbian Exchange, as they say, here on Dear Hank and John. The partnership is between NASA and, I'm not kidding you, Lima's International Potato Center, which is a thing that exists. There are many, 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 many different varieties of potato. We do not see the vast majority of them here in the U.S. grocery stores, but there are 4,500 varieties that are registered at Lima's International Potato Center, and hundreds of them will, including some genetically modified ones, will be used to be sent through a series of tests to see how good they would be at producing potatoes. Not just potatoes for one generation, but potatoes for many generations of potatoes on the surface of Mars. And that is, we've got to deal with the amounts of the soil will need to be cleaned up before it is, if we're on Mars, the Martian soil will be need to cleaned up to some extent before this is done. But you got to test for salt, the amount of light that they need, the amount of water that they need. It's best if they use less water and produce more potato. There's like a radiation concern. So, but they are confident that at least some of these potatoes will pass through these tests, and we will have the right stuff for going to potato land with. And by potato land, I mean Mars, and that's what we're going to call it.
Well, but someday it will be known as potato land. All of our potatoes will be grown on Mars. We'll just we'll eat nothing but Martian food. Earth will be for humans, Mars for potatoes.
If there's only one food, John, it should obviously be potato.
I mean, if you're only going to have one food, potatoes is not a bad option. Okay, so before we go, we need to answer a few things from previous episodes that have been brought to our attention via our email address, hankandjohn@gmail.com. First off, Hank, Mel wrote in about cereal. In your latest podcast, John confessed he puts water on his cereal. This intrigued me because I hate milk. I thought putting water on cereal was generally unacceptable and that nobody would actually try it. But hearing that at least one person in the world has not only tried it, but does it regularly, I thought I had no reason not to try it myself. So this morning, I had water on my cereal, and as advertised, watered cereal provides the same softness that milk does without having to add actual milk. This has saved my breakfast. No longer will I suffer the grossness of milk or cut the roof of my mouth on dry cereal. I don't care if I get judgmental looks in the morning. I can finally enjoy cereal in a way I never could have before. Thank you for revolutionizing my mornings. Sincerely, Mel. You are welcome, Mel.
Well, it's hard for me to argue with that, John. It's hard for me to say that you are the monster that you are after Mel has had this wonderful life-changing experience. But
we've also gotten about 400 emails from people who are disgusted by me.
And an awful lot of comments, because you made a whole video about this. We've also got a message from Till, who says that not only are there feral cows in British Columbia and Hawaii, but also in Hong Kong. And yes, Hong Kong. There are feral cows in Hong Kong.
I'm not even kidding you. Jeff made some made some corn dog cake for his kids, and it wasn't bad. And he attached a picture of his kids, and they do indeed look very happy. Amanda writes in to say that she works at a food bank in Alameda County, and thus knows all about how long food lasts after its sell-by date. And indeed, macaroni and cheese is perfectly fine. In fact, dried pasta is usually good 2 years after the sell-by date. And she includes a PDF from the Alameda County Food Bank that it is a guide for how long you can eat things after their sell-by dates. Remarkable.
We're going to go ahead and post that as well as some pictures of feral cows in Hong Kong to our Patreon page, which you can access even if you don't donate, but feel free to donate. So you can see both of that. I thought it was, I have to say, having read Amanda's email, I was dead wrong about food and how long it's good for. And as she says, John, you have fallen prey to what the food manufacturers want you to think about as food safety, but is really about wanting their products to be at peak flavor. So that's really important and an interesting point, and one that I will bear in mind for the rest of my life. So we all learned something today, Hank. But what else did we learn?
We learned that sometimes when your team doesn't score any goals and is being absolutely ripped to little tiny pieces by the other team, it doesn't matter, and you can still have a good time, because really it's about camaraderie and singing songs and being together and believing in the same things.
And we learned that strawberry flavor is not strawberry flavor, but it is delicious.
Ethyl methyl phenyl glycidate. We learned that John has this strategy called empathic listening, which is has something to do with Deanna Troi from Star Trek.
We also learned that Hank doesn't really listen to me when I'm talking on Dear Hank and John. Oh, man. And lastly, we learned that grief is complicated and that you shouldn't judge yourself for it, but that you should just go on.
Yeah. You shouldn't judge yourself if you need to get yourself a donut. Let's go get a donut.
Yeah. Just enjoy an evening donut. Speaking of which, Hank, two different employees here at the Indianapolis offices of Dear Hank and John brought in Friday donuts.
Oh,
so
wow.
We have 3 dozen donuts for just 9 people. It's an absolute donut bonanza here today, and I'm so grateful to everyone. I look forward to seeing if I can eat 10 donuts by myself.
All right, donut disaster. Donut disaster 2016. It happened. And it's good. So it's, oh, I should also mention that Dear Hank and John now has an intern. Thanks to our lovely support at Patreon, we've been able to bring on a paid intern. Her name is Claudia, and Claudia will be helping out with Dear Hank and John in various ways. So if you ever interact with Claudia, I don't know why you would, but she will be helping out. Mostly she'll be helping out us. We will still be doing all the public-facing things. Actually, in fact, this voice that you're hearing now is actually Claudia's impression of me. I'm not doing this at all. That's what the intern does. She just...
Yeah, no, it was Claudia doing both of us. Introducing herself. Yeah. Yeah. In fact, the whole podcast has been hosted by Claudia. She's doing both of our voices. She's doing a great job. I'm really impressed with her
stuff,
work
yeah,
so
wonderful.
Far. The best part about her doing this podcast is that she's so successfully made it not funny.
Yeah, it's a really a remarkable spot on impression of two guys really just struggling with being interesting and their own mortality. And not really caring at all whether or not the things that they say on this comedy podcast could ever be considered in any planet, you know, Meloria, Mars, or Earth.
Meloria is my new favorite planet. Okay, Hank, we really have to go. Today's podcast was edited by Nicholas Jenkins and possibly Claudia. I don't know. Our theme music is by Gunnarola. My voice is giving out. And as we say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome. Thank you.